Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled A History of the United States Economy in the 20th Century. The lecturer is Professor Timothy Taylor of the University of Minnesota. Professor Taylor is managing editor of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, an academic journal published quarterly by the American Economic Association. Taylor received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Haverford College in 1982 and a master's degree in economics from Stanford University in 1984. Professor Taylor has taught introductory economics at Stanford University and at the University of Minnesota. At Stanford, he was the winner of the Award for Excellent Teaching in a Large Class given by the Associated Students of Stanford University. At Minnesota, he was named a Distinguished Lecturer by the Department of Economics. Since 1989, Tim has written an economics opinion column for the San Jose Mercury News, and many of his columns have been disseminated nationally over the Knight Ridder Tribune wire. He and his wife live near Lake Harriet in the southwest corner of Minneapolis. Lecture 1, The Curtain Opens on the 20th Century.
As a preview to these series of lectures, it's worth spelling out just a little bit how a focus on the U.S. economy is different than a focus on U.S. history in general over the entire 20th century. The dictionary definition of economic things is of, relating to, or based on the production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services. In more everyday and homely terms, what that means is that in talking about the economy, what we want to focus on is how people worked and lived during the 20th century, a sense of what the climate for business was like, including both corporate behavior and union behavior. We want to include a sense of what's happening in the national economy, including things like recessions and inflation and growth. And we want to give a sense of the international context in which this is happening, including trade of goods and services, movement of capital, and immigration. Now, as I say that, it sounds kind of all-inclusive, so maybe it's useful to try and give a sense of what we're not going to be trying to cover in these lectures. This is not a political history, although we will mention politics from time to time. It's not a social history, although, of course, we'll need to talk about social trends at different places. It's not a business history, although some people tend to confuse economics and business. Business is only a part of what's happening in the overall economy. And it's not a history of government as a whole, even though, of course, government certainly plays an important role in the economy, especially in the second half of the century. I'm sure that moving through the 20th century will end up raising a lot of questions that we can't answer in the time allotted to us together. I hope this isn't frustrating for you. After all, knowing enough to ask more meaningful questions is not a bad working definition of what education is really all about. Let's start off with a snapshot of the U.S. economy in 1900. Many pictures give you a different impression if you look at them from different angles, and this is true if you look at the U.S. economy as well. From the perspective of that time, the U.S. was the wealthiest economy in the world, extraordinarily rich, extraordinarily well off. From the perspective of the present, looking back at 1900, the people look tremendously poor. So let's take both of those perspectives. First of all, let's think about the perspective of that time, how we were thought of as the wealthiest people in the world. A typical rough measure of the standard of living in a country is to take the size of the economy, as measured by the gross domestic product, and divide it by the population of that country. When you do that, you get per capita GDP, per capita gross domestic product. An economist named Angus Madison has done this for the United States and for a number of other countries that had fairly developed economies at the beginning of the century. And his calculations show that in 1900, the U.S. was the world leader in per capita gross domestic product. We were about 5% ahead of Great Britain, which was number two. Now, Frankly, given the quality of statistics in 1900, I wouldn't hang a whole lot on something that's 5% different. My guess is that 5% means basically the US and Britain had the same standard of living in 1900. The other country that was pretty much at that same level, interestingly enough, was Australia at that time. But those three countries, the US, Britain, and Australia, were far, far ahead of the rest of the world. For example, measured in per capita GDP, we were almost literally double the wealth of France or of Germany, almost triple rich nations of Latin America like Argentina or Chile, and literally quadruple the standard of living of Japan or Mexico, which had about the same standard of living at the start of the century. At the turn of the century, the U.S. is just taking over global industrial leadership. There are books coming out in Europe, popular books that they're selling widely on the continent, with names like The American Invaders and The Americanization of the World and The American Invasion. It sort of sounds like a lot of the rhetoric you heard in the 1980s in the United States about Japan invading our markets and that sense of America taking over. The total population at that time was 76 million people, which compares to a population of about 260 million toward the end of the century. So we had about 30%, about a third of the population we would have at the end of the century. African Americans were by far the largest minority group at the turn of the century. They were about 12% of the population, which interestingly is about the same percentage as today. What's America doing and making? The Western frontier has closed by about 1900. We're not expanding out into more and more land. Most of our economic growth is coming from greater amounts of labor and large increases in the labor supply, as well as drawing on the really rich natural resources of the country. America's making things like machine-made tools, or shoes, and textiles and machine tools. We're making blast furnaces for producing iron, which in turn lead to railroads, construction industries, and a whole group of manufactured goods. In large part, this level of manufacturing is being driven by discoveries of oil and coal and rich natural resources. At the turn of the century, the U.S. is the world's leading producer of copper, iron ore, zinc, phosphate, molybdenum, lead, tungsten, and many, many other minerals. Now, of course, just being rich in minerals is not enough to make a wealthy economy. A country like Brazil, for example, was very rich in minerals. But the United States also developed the kind of economy which could take advantage of its labor resources and its natural resources and convert them into economic growth. So a combination of cheap and available resources, together with a huge and growing internal market, together with techniques of mass manufacturing and production, together with innovations in transportation and communication, are linking everything together. And we really are the powerhouse of the world at that point. Now, what do we think about if we look back at that from the perspective of today and how the people were living at that time? Compared to today, we would think that a lot of those people were living in dire poverty. In 1900, 3% of the homes in the country are lit by electricity. And the other 88% are coal, oil, kerosene, and a few homes are lit by gas as well. In 1900, maybe a third of the homes in the U.S. have running water. In rural areas, almost none of them have running water. Only 15% of homes in the country have flush toilets. In fact, half of farm households in rural areas don't even have outhouses, biffies constructed to collect sewage. Bodily waste is not being disposed of in that careful way in 1900, even in an outhouse. Travel around town, if you lived in a city, was typically walking or horse, given the bad kinds of roads and things like that. Making 3 miles an hour walking pace was pretty good. Only one urban household in five owned a horse, so most people lived within about a mile of where they worked. Half of all families lived in spaces where they had more than one person per room. It was common to take in lodgers into your house, and among recent immigrants from Europe, it was common to have three or more people in a bedroom. We were also heavy drinkers at the turn of the century. Half of the population drank off alcohol, half didn't. But of the half who drank alcohol, on average, they consumed about 2 hard drinks a day and 2 beers a day. They didn't drink very much wine. By the standards of that time, by the standards of Europe, we were actually a light drinking country. In Europe, they tended to drink about twice as much beer, and also they drank about 30 glasses of wine a week per person on average. So at least in that way, the U.S. was a more restrained country. In terms of health and education at the turn of the century, the life expectancy then is about 47 years at birth. Right now, it's about 75. One reason it was so low at the time was that infant mortality was so high. Out of every 1,000 babies born, about 140 would die in the first year of life, so about 14%, one out of every seven. Now, out of 1,000 babies born, fewer than 10 will die in the first year of life. People died of things like flu and pneumonia, which used to be called the old man's friend. They died of tuberculosis and of gastritis. They died of typhoid and measles and whooping cough. People still get these things, but they're not leading causes of death anymore. In terms of education, there's a major surge in school attendance in the late 19th century. And so, as the 1900s are dawning, we think of it as a time when the U.S. is one of the best educated nations in the world. At that time, 10% of the population is illiterate. I don't mean they're functionally illiterate, like they have a hard time with tax forms or the New York Times. I mean true, can't read the alphabet kind of illiteracy. In the 5 to 19 age bracket, about half of whites and a third of blacks were enrolled in school at any given time. So school-age kids, 5 to 19, many are not in school. The typical adult had left school after about the 8th grade. The average pupil attended 100 days of school a year. So if you think that out, that's about 25-day weeks or maybe about 5 months of school a year. And only about 7% of students completed high school. When it comes to college, there were a total of 27,000 bachelor's degrees given in the whole country in 1900. And in all academic specialties combined, in 1900, there were a total of 382 PhD degrees given. Right now, a single large university like a Harvard or a Stanford probably gives more than 382 PhDs in a year. What about work and how people were working in 1900? For men, you can really have to separate apart men's work and women's work. Men's work, a typical work week, is 6 days a week, 60 hours of work that week, so 6 10-hour days. In terms of jobs, about a little more than a third of all workers are on the farm. However, the total number of people working on farms is peaking at the early part of the century and will begin a gradual decline that goes through the rest of the 20th century. So a third of the people are on the farm, about a third are manual workers, which would include things like laborers and crafts and different things like that, and a little less than a third were white-collar or service workers, which includes everything from professional and managers to jobs like clerical and sales and different things like that. Many workers are unskilled, and jobs are often held for very short times or seasonally. You might work until your business goes broke or the weather turns bad or something like that, then be out of work for a while. If you aren't good at your job, management fires you, cuts your pay, there's nothing you can really say about it. They manage by the stick, as we'll talk about later on. Pensions are rare. Men tend to work all their lives until they're too sick or feeble to continue. About two-thirds of men over age 65 have jobs and are still working. In a good year, the unemployment rate is about 5%, which is an interestingly similar number to what unemployment would be in a good year at the end of the century. But remember, the nature of work is a lot different. People are going in and out of the labor force. There are more people working in farming. And so even thinking about what unemployment means is a little bit tricky at the turn of the century. What about women's work? Women were only about 18% of the overall workforce. To put it another way, only about 6% of wives are in the paid labor force. Now, those numbers are probably a little low because at the time, women in the paid labor force, that was considered sort of a stigma. It was considered something that a good woman, a good wife, would not be in the paid workforce. So when you surveyed people at that time, it's not always clear you got honest answers. And what sort of jobs did they do? They tended to be limited to a very narrow range of industries, things like textiles, apparel, shoes, canning, and they tended to be jobs where you were paid specifically according to how much you produced. How many sweaters did you knit? How many cans did you get canned? Different things like that. Of course, the fact that women didn't work so much in the paid labor force did not mean they were sitting on their hands. Estimates of time spent in households at the turn of the century say that women spent maybe 40 hours a week on meals and meal cleanup, another 7 hours a week on laundry, another 7 hours a week on cleaning. And don't forget things like childcare and gardening and making and repairing clothes and filling the stove with coal. And this is the age before the microwave oven. A great deal of food preparation is done at home, baking, canning, cooking, all kinds of things like that. Give you one example. The average housewife in 1900, the average, baked half a ton of bread a year. That works out to about 3 pounds of bread a day, or maybe 1,400 loaves a year. The morning baking was something that you did over and over. Another example, the average woman at the time had to carry water back into the house. Remember, we don't have running water yet. So those women carried thousands of gallons a year. One estimate for farm wives at the time was that typically they carried water 60 yards each way, six times a day. Children also worked at the time. Child labor is widespread. About 25% of boys between the ages of 10 and 15 have a job listed in the 1900 census. Of course, most of them are working in agriculture, but you have to remember that boys and children in general are considered adults at about age 14 or 15, and they're going to go into the workforce at that time. If we were to sum all this up overall in terms of our sort of rough and ready measure of per capita GDP, we can do kind of a back of the envelope calculation here and give you a sense of where we're standing. The gross domestic product in 1900 is $19 billion for the whole country. Now, if we adjust that for inflation up to the present, we have to multiply that by about a factor of 20. So let's choose round numbers. Say the GDP was about $20 billion. We multiply by 20 to adjust for inflation. So in current dollars, that would be about $400 billion, some number like that. We divide by the population of 76 million. Again, let's choose round numbers and say the population was 80 million. So we've got 400 billion divided by 80 million population, and that works out to about $5,000 a person per capita GDP in present kinds of dollars. That's less than a fifth of the current level of per capita GDP. It's roughly, if you wanted to have a modern day comparison, the equivalent for a country like Mexico in the present day. Of course, there's a big difference when you have that standard of living and it's the very best in the world compared to if you have that standard of living and you can see all the modern technology and other people out, you know, other countries having things you can't necessarily afford. But it's hard to really think about these things, but it's important to be aware of the enormous gap that separates the standard of living at that time from our standard of living today. But oddly enough, this time at the turn of the century, which in many ways looks so different from our own times, has some odd similarities to the present in terms of the public concerns that were really engaging people of the time. In fact, there have been some recent arguments that many of our current disputes and public policy disputes have loud echoes that are going on during the time at the turn of the century. Let me give you some examples of some things which were big issues then and are still big issues now. One was the globalization of the economy. At the turn of the century, although merchandise exports are going up and down from year to year, it was often true that exports were about 6% of the overall economy, 6% of GDP. Now, to put this in perspective, in 1990, U.S. exports were 7% of GDP, which is hardly a large shift. To give you a little preview of the coming story here, there's a decline in world trade following World War I and a bigger decline during the Great Depression. And it's not really until the 1950s that world trade begins rebuilding again toward the levels that existed already at the turn of the century. Now, what caused the trade boom in the late 19th century? Well, a lot of it was things like falling transportation costs. There were railroads going back and forth across the land. There were steamships going back and forth across the waters. So transportation became a lot easier, and that made trade a lot easier. One measure of that is that if you have two areas where trade back and forth between them is easy, prices will tend to be the same in those two areas. If they weren't the same, people would take from the expensive area and ship over to the cheap one. Jeff Williamson, a Harvard economist, had noted that grain in Liverpool cost 60% more than grain in Chicago in 1870. So there's a big gap at that time. But by 1910, the gap between the two is less than 15%. So transportation is equalizing prices. Moreover, communications have really changed. The transatlantic U.S.-Britain telegraph opened in 1866, so investors were able to invest back and forth across the ocean with a one-day delay instead of the three-week delay if you had to ship your orders across by ship. This is a huge change in bringing together financial markets. The ability to get information on a one-day turnaround instead of a three-week turnaround is arguably just an enormous shift. We sometimes pretend to ourselves that we people at the end of the 20th century are the first ones to have to deal with big shifts like this. But when you think about it, a new computer, which lets you get something in, say, 10 seconds instead of 30 seconds, That kind of a shift is much less important than the kind of a shift which changes your communication patterns from 3 weeks to 1 day. That's an enormous change in how things are going to function. Sure, the level of the global economy is a little bit less at the turn of the century. The level of technology is not what it is today. But the impact of changing technology on people's lives really was extreme, and they knew it. It was felt at the time. A second concern from the turn of the century, which is also relevant today, is the surge in immigration that was happening through the late 19th century and into the 20th century. At the turn of the century, 26% of the U.S. population had been born abroad. Think of it, more than a quarter of the U.S. population had been born overseas and had come here. Now, this really started at the later part of the 19th century, and it continues up through about 1920, this surge in immigration. And of course, immigration is a controversial issue both then and now. The standard way to think about immigration from an economics point of view is to think about, you know, who's helped and who's hurt. And to take it out of the context of immigration for a moment, let's just imagine that we have some new discovery, like we discover a new silver mine. Who's helped, who's hurt by the discovery of the new mine? Well, anyone who currently has a silver mine is hurt by the discovery of the new mine, because after all, they have new competition to deal with, and it's going to push down the price. On the other hand, people who buy silver and use stuff from the silver mine are benefited by the discovery of the new mine, because after all, they benefit from the lower price. Now, exactly the same is going to be true of immigration. Immigrants who tend to be low-skilled are going to hurt existing low-skilled workers, because they're competing with them to sell labor. However, those people who benefit from buying things immigrants provide, and the economy as a whole, tend to benefit from purchasing those things which can be provided at a less expensive price. So then as now, immigrants are coming in, low-skilled people are worried about the immigrants getting their jobs, but there's a reasonable argument that for the economy as a whole, this provision of things at lower prices is a positive thing. Although certainly some people are helped and some people are hurt by that. These concerns, of course, are similar to concerns about immigration today. This is also a time of transforming new technologies, technologies which are really reshaping the way people work and live. One of those technologies is electricity, and some fairly recent writings by the economic historian Paul David have really emphasized how electricity was reshaping the world at this time. Now, of course, electricity is fairly well understood in the late 19th century. Thomas Edison's carbon filament light goes back to about 1879. And in the 1890s, there are electric trolley cars up and running in more than 100 U.S. cities. So, I mean, electricity is not a big mystery at this point. But while electricity could be focused on particular things like trolley cars, or it could light a particular light at a particular place, it wasn't yet widespread. And many people date the real birth of electricity to the 1900 World's Fair in Paris, where for the first time they had giant dynamos running and they illuminated the streets of a city with electrical light rather than gas light. And that was really a demonstration that electricity could power a city in a way that people really weren't altogether sure of at that time. Now, electricity is thought of as a transforming technology in the sense that modern computer technology is also a transforming technology. What I mean by transforming is that it's sort of a background invention which allows people to do all kinds of other things. Once you have electricity, that reshapes how you produce things. It reshapes the products that are possible. It reshapes how people are going to live their day-to-day lives in fundamental kinds of ways. The trick to remember, though, is that these kinds of transforming technologies, like electricity, take decades and decades before they work their magic power of transformation. They do so many different things that it takes a long time for their effects to become clear. So even though electricity is fairly well understood by 1900, it really isn't until about the 1920s that we're going to see it have an extraordinary impact on the American economy. In the 1900s, it's still sort of a background feature that's changing a lot of things, but hasn't fundamentally changed how everyone lives. Another transforming technology, of course, is the internal combustion engine, the horseless carriage, as we would call it in the spirit of the time. There are literally dozens of experimenters with cars functioning at the turn of the century, including Henry Ford, the Dodge brothers, Ransom Olds, and many others. It's kind of like the excitement that surrounds the computer chip in the 1970s and 1980s, or the excitement that surrounds the internet at the end of the century. It's really thought of as a hot new technology. As early as 1903, there are over 100 auto manufacturers in the United States, but most of them are making a very small number of cars in a handmade kind of way, not on assembly lines. Of course, over the next several decades, and again in the 1920s in particular, the car is going to transform American ways of industry and ways of living and traveling. But at the turn of the century, you could kind of see that transformation coming if you looked ahead a little bit. This is a time when there is deep fear and distrust of large corporations, much as there is toward the end of the century. To give a sense of the public tone and arguments over these things, let me give you a few famous stories of the time. One's the story of a muckraking journalist named Ida Tarbell, who wrote a series of articles published in McClure's magazine about Standard Oil Company and how John D. Rockefeller had built Standard Oil. Tarbell went through all the legal documents and all the legal battles and all the public records that Rockefeller had fought, all the accusations there had been against him, all the sworn depositions. And he wrote what we would think of today as investigating kind of journalism. His history of the Standard Oil Company is carefully traced. It's a fairly dull read, but interesting in its own way. He gives painstaking detail of how Rockefeller drives out the competition and drives people into bankruptcy. You know, he would cut down prices, cut off their transportation links, deny them supplies, and then buy them out and add them to his Standard Oil Company. Tarbell at one point describes how Rockefeller saw this situation. He said, "To Mr. Rockefeller, to place love of independent work above love of profits was incomprehensible. When persuasion failed, then, it was necessary, in his judgment, that pressure be applied. Simply a pressure sufficient to demonstrate to these blind or recalcitrant individuals the impossibility of their long being able to do business independently. It was a pressure varied according to locality. Usually it took the form of cutting their market. The system of predatory competition was no invention of the Standard Oil Company. It had prevailed in the oil business from the start. Indeed, it was one of the evils Mr. Rockefeller claimed his combination would cure. But until now, predatory competition had been used spasmodically. Mr. Rockefeller never did anything spasmodically. He applied underselling for destroying his rival's market with the same deliberation and persistency that characterized all his efforts, and in the long run, he always won. There were other forms of pressure. Sometimes the independents found it impossible to get oil. Again, they were obliged to wait days for cars to ship it in. There seemed to be no end to the ways of making it hard for men to do business, of discouraging them till they would sell or lease. And always at the psychological moment, a purchaser was at their side." And so, year after year, decade after decade, Rockefeller drove out the competition. And by the turn of the century, Standard Oil had perhaps 90% of the market for refining petroleum. Another classic example is that of Upton Sinclair. Some of you may have read a book called The Jungle, which Sinclair wrote in the turn of the century. It's not really a very good novel, but it's a powerful polemic about the Chicago meatpacking industry at the time, the terrible health and safety conditions under which people worked. And that book, you know, really gave people a look at the dirty underside of industry in the best tradition of muckraking journalists. Mergers were really a major movement in the late 1890s and the early part of this decade. One historian has studied this period and compiled a long, long list of where these mergers, like the Standard Oil mergers and others, combined to let someone control more than 70% of an industry. I just wanted to read you names of a couple of the consolidations which happened between 1895 and 1904 of companies which controlled more than 70% of the national market. And as you listen to them, think about the things that are being made and produced at the time. Some of these companies that controlled more than 70% of the market are the American Brake Shoe and Foundry, American Can, American Chicle, American Fork and Hoe, American Hide and Leather, American Ice, American Locomotive, American School Furniture, American Seating Machine, American Snuff, American Stogie, American Window Glass, American Writing Paper. And so you have this sense of all these companies sort of coming together that are really controlling large amounts of the market. As you run down the list, you you run into some companies which are still around today, like DuPont and Eastman Kodak, International Harvester, Otis Elevator. And many of those companies that still exist today were formed out of big mergers at the turn of the century. Now, you may say we don't trust big corporations today. Well, let me tell you, compared to those days, our modern corporate folks look like real sweethearts. They look like kindly men and women who just, you know, don't try and hurt their competition too much. At this time, the philosophy was if you had a competitor, you drove them out of business, and you drove them out of business by whatever means you could. You bought them up, and you formed some sort of a large group, a large industry in one form or another, which would run that company and run that industry. It's important to remember also that a lot of this is happening through very complicated financial and legal transactions. And so this sense of not trusting the people who do these mergers and takeovers, not trusting these lawyers who carry these shenanigans through. We think sometimes all of this is, you know, the late 20th century. But believe me, at the turn of the century, it was the hot issue of the day. It was what the progressive movement of that time was worried about. What was government doing through all of this? What was the role of government at the turn of the century? Well, in many ways, you can think of the federal government at that time and the lawmaking power of the government as virtually invisible. Not completely so, but as a rough approximation, it's close to invisible. I'm not even going to bother talking about the federal budget. It's so tiny. It's less than 2% of the size of the economy. It's true that they had passed a law having an income tax in the 1890s, but it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So there's no income tax. All the taxes are in the form, most of them are in the form of tariffs, taxes on imported goods. And the Federal Reserve System doesn't yet exist. So our typical tools of government policy, taxes, spending, the Fed, just aren't really there. When we think about government policy at the time, it's really in reaction to these people like Ida Tarbell and his talk about trusts and large corporations. The Sherman Antitrust Act is passed in 1890, and that's one act that a lot of people have heard of to try and break up these large corporations. But what exactly were these trusts that we were so anti about? I mean, what era is the antitrust laws about? Remember, this is a time when greater methods of communication, greater methods of transportation are binding the nation together, raising the possibility that you really can run a huge enterprise, all interconnected, because you've got the ability to do it with the transportation and communication links. Moreover, it seems true that large factories are able to produce more cheaply on a per unit basis than many of the smaller factories. So these big combinations, these Rockefeller Standard Oils, are driving out the small independent producers. Well, how can we work this legally to create these kinds of large organizations? A trust, in the particular legal sense, was when a majority of the shareholders in a whole bunch of companies would take their stock in the company and turn it over to trustees. In exchange, when they turned over their stock to the trustees, they got what were called trust certificates, which let them share in the overall profits of the trust. Then the trustees, who controlled all the companies, could run all the companies like a monopoly. And since there was less competition, they could jack up the price and earn higher profits than they would have before. Now, we don't really have trusts today, but what we did get were things like holding companies and mergers, which effectively did the same thing. They took a whole bunch of independent competitors and put them together under one roof. The Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1890, but it had very little force for the next 20 years or so. Part of the reason was that the Antitrust Act was not very clear about what was illegal. Was it illegal just to be a big company? Was just size itself illegal? Or was did you have to do something, engage in some sort of predatory practice, drive people out in some way? And was that practice what was illegal? And so those sorts of ideas really hadn't been very thoroughly worked out. It was also true that the executive branch of government in the 1890s basically made it pretty clear that they didn't think this law let them do much of anything, and they were just not very interested in trying to enforce it. So those problems in definition were made even worse by an unwillingness to even try and enforce the law in various ways. At this time, when social legislation is proposed, it's running into the entrenched interests of big business, and it's running into the Supreme Court as well. Remember, I mentioned a moment ago that the Supreme Court was throwing out legislation it didn't like the income tax. It was often throwing out other kinds of social legislation as well. Legislation to limit the number of hours men worked, for example. Legislation to require certain levels of pay. Legislation to regulate working conditions. The court's argument was always the same. It was, hey, if people want to work in unsafe conditions for long hours at low wages, that's their constitutional right. And the state can't come along and ban people from making those kinds of arrangements in the workplace if that's what they want to do. And so that idea of what the Constitution meant blocked all kinds of social legislation. To give you a sense of how the Constitution was used, in one 1908 Supreme Court case, the United Hatters had staged a boycott against firms using non-union labor. The Hatters were a labor union. And they were found by the Supreme Court that because they had staged a boycott as a union, that the union was guilty of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act. And moreover, that the members of the union were individually liable for damages because of the boycott. And individually, they had to pay money and were fined because they were willing to do a boycott like that. In 1908, the Supreme Court did uphold an Oregon law that set a 10-hour workday for women, which sort of sounds like maybe this is some kind of a step toward limiting the hours people work. But it was only limited for women on the grounds that women needed protection because they were the ones who bore children. And in fact, you can really think of it as a way of making discouraging firms from hiring women. Because after all, women were going to be limited in the number of hours they could work, and men would be able to keep working the longer hours if that seemed important. In 1906, Congress did pass a Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was somewhat in response to Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, about how terrible the meatpacking industry is. And this has long been a proud moment for social reformers, and it should be. But, you know, big meatpacking interests supported these acts. And the reason they supported them was they thought that it would help them drive out the little guys who were their competitors. And they thought government would come in, and by setting up these regulations, they would be able to comply with the government regulations, but their small competitors would be driven out of business because they wouldn't be able to pay the regulatory costs. So whenever you think about regulation, you should always think to yourself, not just does it sound good at first glance, but is it playing a role to help companies shut out competition? Because often businesses love to have a situation where they can try and form a trust or get government to block competition in one way or another. The 1900s are a time when there is inflation and there is a certain amount of financial chaos. The banking system is a mess. The country is still being run under banking laws from the Civil War, and these laws in particular set different rules for big banks and for little banks. The big banks had to hold more reserves than the little banks, and they had a harder time loaning money out. So as a result, the big banks started doing risky things with money. They would play the stock market and stuff like that. And they would find all sorts of ways to speculate in raw materials prices like iron or copper. So ups and downs in the stock market or in the economy could really hit the banks badly. It's a time when the economy is running on a gold standard. And it's worth saying briefly what a gold standard is, since people don't really remember anymore these days. In a literal sense, a gold standard means you can trade money for gold and gold for money. And the two are in some sense identical with each other. Now, what that implies is that as we get more and more and more gold, we also have more and more and more money in the system. And we're kind of counting on the amount of gold to expand in such a way that it will expand along and lift up the amount of money to the amount that we need. Now, there were some problems that occur in this kind of a system. Toward the 1880s, 1890s, into the early 1900s, the world gold supply had been growing really slowly. There hadn't been very many new discoveries of gold. It had maybe been growing 1.5% a year. That meant the supply of money is growing very slowly. And if the supply of money is growing slowly, then there's not a lot of money and credit out there. It's hard to borrow money, and the economy keeps stumbling into recessions, and even in the mid-1890s, something that's close to a Great Depression. But the market does have a way of solving problems like this. Gold discoveries get made in the 1890s in South Africa, in Alaska, in Colorado. There are new processes for mining and refining gold, and the amount of gold starts growing at about 3.5% a year instead of 1.5% a year. All of a sudden, money is not scarce anymore. Money starts growing fairly rapidly. In fact, too rapidly. And as a result, we start having inflation of about 2% a year through a lot of these years in the 1900s. Now, 2% a year sounds fairly trivial to us, but when you've had essentially zero inflation or even slightly declining prices for a couple of previous decades, inflation of 2% a year seems actually kind of worrisome at the time. In fact, from 1897 to 1902, inflation got up to 6% a year, which at that time, again, is just an extraordinary shock. Now, this actually is the pattern why most economists then and now don't see having a gold standard as a very good thing for an economy. I mean, after all, think about it for a moment. A gold standard means that your money supply grows directly along with gold. If there are lots of gold discoveries or uses for gold or technology that changes, your money supply gets jerked up and down. Now, of course, you can say, well, you know, we're not going to have it exactly tied to gold. We're going to have it tied to gold, and then if things happen, we'll do various kinds of adjustments. But once you've said that, once you've said we're going to make various kinds of adjustments, you're really saying it's not a gold standard anymore. You're saying it's a standard of adjustments that you're going to make as necessary over time. And that's essentially how we've decided to run the money supply since then. Sure, we look at gold prices, we look at prices of everything. But overall, we just try and keep the money supply growing at a rate which won't cause inflation and shall keep the economy growing along steadily. There is one shallow recession early in this decade, running from about 1902 to 1904. But the important recession we want to talk about is the Panic of 1907. Because the Panic of 1907 is what leads to the creation of the Federal Reserve in the next decade. In March 1907, the stock market drops 30% in 2 weeks. A sharp recession follows. The economy shrinks by more than 10% between 1907 and 1908. What happened? Well, remember, we're on a gold standard at this time. And what's happening is that gold is leaving Europe and flowing to the United States. It's not entirely clear to me why this was happening. It may have been there were wars in Europe and the United States looked like a safer place for gold. But at any rate, the European countries said, we can't let gold be leaving our country. We can't be losing our money in this way. What we need to do is raise our interest rates so that people will start investing money back in Europe. The return will be higher there. They'll be able to get their money there. Now, what happens as the gold starts leaving the United States? Well, the stock market starts, in the U.S., we start saying, well, we have to raise our interest rates too, so we don't lose the gold and it doesn't head over to Europe. And when that happens, people start bailing out of the stock market and investing their money in bonds to take advantage of these higher interest rates. Now, the stock market starts dropping. As the stock market goes down, remember, this really hurts the banks because the banks at that time are investing in the stock market and investing in things like the stock market. So the banks begin to have all sorts of troubles. Many banks don't have enough reserves. They have to temporarily close down. People and companies don't have money available. Business is really severely disrupted. And while this all kind of works its way out after about 6 months or so, there's a 10% collapse in the economy in between. There's a sense that we need something different. And a law is passed in 1908, the Aldrich Vreeland Act, it's called, which authorizes banks to work together to think about how they could supply each other money in these kinds of situations. It also sets up a commission, and the commission is going to recommend for the future that there will be things like deposit insurance, so people's deposits can be insured and protected in the banks. There will be things like they'll recommend there be a central reserve of currency someplace. So if a bank is short of currency, it can be brought out from some central location and distributed. And there is a whole other set of detailed proposals, which eventually will lead to the birth of the Federal Reserve System in the next decade. When I look back on the 1900s, it's sometimes said that America's Wild West, the frontier West, really closed in about 1890. When I look back at the 1900s, I kind of think of it as the time when red-blooded, entrepreneurial, cutthroat American capitalism is really at its peak. I mean, cutthroat in the sense of there aren't very many laws about what a business can do. There aren't very many laws about how it can attack other businesses. There aren't very many health and safety standards. There's not much government at all. It's kind kind of an attitude of, you know, why should I worry about the government? What matters here is making as much money as possible. It's a time of, you know, coal and iron and railroads. It's a time of robber barons and of banking and financial shenanigans. It's a time when people really felt like they were on top of the world, that somehow this was the energy and the power of these new inventions and these new companies had really lifted the United States to the top of the world and made our standard of living the very, very best. In fact, at that time, people pretty much felt, you know, this was it. This was the culmination of modern industrial progress. It was hard for a lot of people to imagine that things could get any better than it was at the turn of the century. The country was only 125 years old, but we had these enormous resources, and it really seemed like we had triumphed. We had done what we could. It's really hard to imagine, but it's important to remember that this is not the end of the story. From our point of view, at the end of the 20th century, on the verge of the 21st century, it's really only the beginning.